The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. Coming up later on in the show, we'll get to that TV interview from Sunday morning. I didn't quite have time to cover that yesterday at the end of the program, so we'll get to that KWTV9 interview there in Oklahoma City. Brad McDonald and Shane Granger speaking on behalf of the church, talking about the new exhibit that's due to open up this Sunday. So lots and lots of activity going on in Edmond, in Jerusalem, as we gear up for the opening receptions to kick off that exhibit. Another really great article today in Breitbart Jerusalem. I'll come to that hopefully on the next segment or the one after as well. Some more positive publicity for this upcoming exhibit. On today's show, we'll also talk about the hysteria over the presidential pardon power. Quite a lot of that in the news, and also because of, well, not just what commentators are saying, but because of what President Trump is tweeting out. So we'll discuss that later on in the show as well. I want to begin, though, with the temporary resurgence. We've talked about this a number of times. This program my father gave a couple of weeks ago, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago now. And then the article from the May issue of the Trumpet magazine, Saving America from the Radical Left. He says that just to paraphrase, he talks about the change in direction for the United States with the new administration that we've had over the past 500 days. Yesterday was the 500th day of the Trump administration. But a clear change in direction, and one that, as my father said, will slow the speed at which America is being pulled apart. I mean, there are some positive things happening, as I've been saying in recent programs. Those headlines I gave to you yesterday, that the New York Times from Friday, about how the job numbers and the growth, the economic growth, I mean, it's all so good, they're having to pull out the thesaurus so that they can come up with some new words to describe it. CNBC said over the weekend that the U.S. economy looks unstoppable. And I noticed this tweet from President Trump just before coming down here this morning. The U.S. has an increased economic value of more than $7 trillion since the election. That's from President Trump. He said it may be the best economy in history, in our history. He talks about the record job numbers. He's excited. A lot of people in his administration are excited. There are a couple more stories that I got in my news updates today. One from the USA Today newspaper, saying that Donald Trump may be what international trade needs. And then another one from The Spectator says, if this is a trade war, the United States will win. The U.S. is going to win. President Trump's also tweeted out how that we've made so many bad trade deals in the past that anything we do different can only be a win comparatively. Well, we know, of course, in the bigger picture, what it's leading to. We know that trade wars are coming. And it's really going to isolate the United States and Great Britain. But in the short term, it may be, like the USA Today says, it may be that this is exactly what international trade needs. A president who's willing to shake things up a bit. And it's not like all the gains have just been economic. I mean, look at the resurgence of the United States as far as geopolitical gains are concerned. The prisoner release, North Korea giving those three American citizens back a few weeks ago. This is not something we're accustomed to seeing. A prisoner swap, that is, that works in our favor. A lopsided prisoner swap in the favor of the United States. And, well, we're just a week away from this summit between North Korea and the United States. That's next week, right at the start of next week. Here's the Trump administration talking about denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. And then going back a few weeks ago as well, pulling out of the Iran nuke deal. And the president calling out Iran for all of their terrorism, sponsoring terrorism, led by a murderous regime, he said. Some strong language, going back to what he said on, the early part of the month of May. Iran and all of their proxies, bombing American embassies and military installations around the world, murdering and kidnapping American citizens. This is a different America. It's a new direction. A change in direction, as my father wrote. Carolyn Glick, she had a piece at Breitbart today about how that President Trump's North Korean strategy, how that it's terrifying Iran. She says, Iran's apparent effort to coordinate its operations with its longtime partner and its fear that North Korea may be in the process of selling out to the Americans is not happening in a vacuum. It says the Trump administration is implementing an across-the-board strategy to isolate Iran from its economic and strategic partners. It says in some cases, like Trump's diplomacy with Pyongyang and the decision to abandon the Iran nuclear deal, the U.S. is implementing its strategy directly. In other areas, the U.S. is using Israel to implement its strategy of isolating Iran. She gives a number of examples. Israel pushing back there in southern Syria, pushing back the Iranian advance. And Israel and the United States working with Russia to just try to isolate Iran all the more now that the hostilities have settled down some in Syria. Michael Oren, as I said yesterday, I've been reading some of his works of late, and I noticed this this clip of his from YouTube last night. I guess this was him. I'm not sure where the venue was that he was giving this speech at. But this was him commenting on the move of the American embassy to Jerusalem just a few weeks ago. And he's talking about just the impact that these kinds of decisions and that these kinds of actions have on the world. Here's clip one.
What happened in Jerusalem this week, and I want to paraphrase John Hagee, will echo in the halls of Damascus. It will reverberate in the streets of Tehran, and not just on a religious level. I come from the world of diplomacy. I come from the world of geostrategic policy. And in that world, the most important quality that a country and a leader can have is credibility. Credibility. When the President of the United States draws a red line, and someone flagrantly crosses that red line, and the president remains inactive, countries take notice. They invade the Ukraine. They send warships into the South China Sea. Everybody takes notice. And so when the president of the United States says he is going to move America's embassy to Jerusalem and recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, when another brave country like Guatemala follows suit, everybody in the world is taking notes. And if you think for a second that that little guy with a strange haircut in North Korea is not taking notes of this, you're mistaken. Believe me, he's taking notes. That the Iranians, and I see the Iranians already blinking. They're blinking all over the place. They're blinking not because because he pulled out of the Iranian nuclear deal. They're blinking because he moved the embassy to Jerusalem.
That's Michael Oren, the former ambassador to the United States from Israel, talking about just the impact of something like moving the American embassy. As courageous as that move was, they're taking notes in Pyongyang. They're taking notes in Tehran. And as Carolyn Glick brings out in her piece this morning, they're terrified of what's happening here. What if they lose Russian support? Of course, we know from Bible prophecy that eventually there's going to be a parting of ways between Iran and Syria. And it could already be happening. That doesn't mean the Iranian threat's going away. They're the king of the south. But what a resurgence. What a difference. It is something to behold. And it's also very temporary, just like it was in the days of Jeroboam II. That program my father gave back on May 13th, I see here in my notes. That's a few weeks ago. God saves Israel temporarily. We know that our peoples, the United States and Britain, little Judah, I mean, we are Israelites. We're the descendants of ancient Israel. And if you look back at our own history, King Jeroboam II, the long, peaceful reign of Jeroboam II, I mean, he was an evil king, it says in 2 Kings 14. But they did experience a resurgence, a time of peace. And that history, as my father brings out in that recent Key of David, that history is prophetic. Here's what he had to say on May 13th. This is clip 12.
Well, you have the history of Israel, and then it is prophetic when God talks about saving Israel. He saved them anciently, temporarily, and he's going to save them in this end time, temporarily. So he can get one more message to them, one more warning. He's given numerous warnings before, but he wants to give one more to give them a chance to repent and turn to God and not be corrected as severely as they will be if they don't respond.
It highlights just how merciful and loving God is, just giving us one more chance. I mean, we were close to total collapse. That close. And he's giving us one more chance. As my father said there, one more warning to repent and turn to God. That's why we're seeing this temporary resurgence. It has to do with God's work. It has to do with God's message. As my father wrote in the corresponding article, he said, God granted mercy when Israel really didn't deserve it. Rather than sending Israel into captivity at that time, God used this king to save Israel, that's Jeroboam II, and to give them one more age of prosperity before Assyrian conquest. One more age. Well, you look at the prophecy over in Amos 7, and it says God won't pass by us anymore. This is the last pass. This is the last time. And I've quoted before from that 1978 Plain Truth, the one my father refers to in his article about the long peaceful reign of Jeroboam II, and how that during that reign anciently, Israel was lulled into a false sense of security. See, we can't let that happen. We can't let it happen this time. Even as we see a resurgence, even as we see some good economic numbers, even as we see in America with a more muscular foreign policy, even as we see more religious activity, we can't be lulled to sleep. It was during all of that, by the way, historically, it was during all of that, the peace, the prosperity, the strength, the increased religious activity, it was during that the prophet Amos showed up to deliver God's warning. And if you look at, well, I mentioned Amos 7 already. I will not again pass by them anymore. If you back up to Amos 6, verse 1 says, woe to those who are at ease in Zion and to those who feel secure on the mountain of Samaria. Here comes the prophet Amos, and he said to the people of Israel at that time, woe unto them who are at ease. Woe unto them who've been lulled into a false sense of security, who put far away the evil day, it says in verse 3. Don't put that evil day far away. It's closer, much closer than we realize. We can't slip into that thinking that Jesus spoke of in Matthew 24. My Lord delays his coming. We're getting very close to the end of this age. Here we are right at the Jeroboam end of all things. When we come back, we'll tie some of this in with the Antiochus administration as well. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can email the program at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
The Trumpet Daily.
It was in 2014, early in 2014. I think it was the State of the Union address, Barack Obama, who stood up that evening and said, "Look, we're not going to wait for legislation anymore to help Americans," the way he put it. "I've got a pen and I've got a phone. And I can use that pen to sign executive orders and to take executive actions and administrative actions that move the ball forward." That's President Barack Obama saying, "I'll go around Congress. I'll do it myself." And the mainstream media, they didn't think that was alarming. They didn't think anything of it at all. They applauded it, in fact. They supported it. Nothing to be alarmed about there. Well, there are a few voices. Certainly, we talked about it at thetrumpet.com. My father wrote about it in America Under Attack. Jonathan Turley at the time, I mean, he was quoted on one of the news shows. Here was one of the few who voiced concern. He was quoted at the time saying, "The key to a Madisonian system is that nobody has enough power to go it alone." That was the genius of James Madison. But we're seeing the rise of a new model of presidency. And I believe that supporters of President Obama will rue the day when they stayed silent in the face of this kind of concentration of power. That's what we saw during the Obama years. There was a concentration of power like the United States had never seen. Look at where those fingerprints are still being observed and seen, as I said yesterday, in all of those intelligence agencies, the so-called deep state. Well, now there's a new president, and it was one that the radical left least expected to ever be in office. They were all operating in a world where Hillary Clinton would win. Just like it says in that recent documentary, The Final Year, and just like James Comey himself said in an interview, they were all operating with that understanding. Well, now Donald Trump's in power, and let me tell you, they are frightened at the prospect of him using his executive power. There was a great piece at the New York Post from the other day about this left-wing hysteria over President Trump's use of the pardon power, And so far, he's had 500 days. So let's get a little bit of perspective here. 500 days in office, almost a year and a half, and he's pardoned five people. And one of the five was the legendary black boxer who died back in 1946. Over the course of his presidency, Barack Obama granted clemency to 1,927 individuals, a total of 1,715 commutations and 212 pardons. 212. According to, and if you remember, when these kinds of things happened, the White House, they celebrated this. There were a lot of people that were convicted and in prison for life. These were not individuals that just happened to smoke a little marijuana and ended up in prison for 30 or 40 years. These were, in many cases, hardened criminals. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And this was something that the Obama White House, they celebrated this. And the media applauded right along with them. According to the Obama White House archives, President Obama granted more commutations than any president in this nation's history and has surpassed the number of commutations granted by the past 13 presidents combined. I mean, it wasn't that long ago when this was supposedly a good thing. The president using his power to pardon, using his power to commute a sentence. Well, he received a lot of petitions for clemency during his presidency because he made it known that he in 2014, he launched the Clemency Initiative, which encouraged inmates, prisoners, to request commutation. Pew Research, it says this, the initiative led to a surge in requests and also helps explain why Obama's use of clemency tilted so heavily towards sentence commutations rather than pardons. So he had a lot of pardons, maybe not as much as other presidents in some cases, but certainly more commutations than anyone else, as his own website bragged about. It says here, this was a little research we did this morning, of the 1,715 commutations, Obama reduced the penalties of 568 individuals serving life sentences. 568. He commuted the sentences of two who had been sentenced to death. These were not individuals that gave $20,000 to a political campaign. These were, in some cases, hardened criminals. So it's important to remember this, just recent history, to bring a little bit of balance to the reporting today. You would think those in the media would try to bring a little bit of balance to it. Five people that have been pardoned by President Trump. Well, because it was Dinesh D'Souza, and it might possibly be Martha Stewart, those are the rumors. And this, we're told, this is a signal. This is President Trump signaling to those who might be investigated, to those who might have obstructed justice. He's sending a signal to Cohen and Manafort and whoever else. That look, just stay true to your principles and you'll be pardoned in the end. Senator Mark Warner talked about this so-called message, Trump sending a message to those being investigated in the Mueller probe. And the message, according to Warner, is that in the United States of America, nobody is above the law. He's saying there, of course, that President Trump is putting himself above the law. The Post article I quoted from, it goes on to say, bingo, that's exactly the point Trump is making. Though he, President Trump, and Warner obviously disagree on who nobody is. To Warner, it's General Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, Trump's former aides and one of his lawyers. The first two face charges brought by Mueller, it says, and Cohen is in the crosshairs of the Justice Department. Warner's fear is that Trump is signaling that a pardon awaits those who are loyal to him. Perhaps so, says the Post. But to Trump, the idea that nobody is above the law applies just as well to Comey, his former FBI deputy, Andrew McCabe, and other Obama-era officials who spied on his presidential campaign and leaked classified information to the liberal media. It's a brilliant piece in many ways, because it besides showing that President Trump is fighting back against all of this evil, it also highlights, doesn't it, just how insoluble our problems really and truly are. I mean, could the House be more bitterly divided than what it is right now? With one side saying, you can't be above the law, and then the other side answers, you can't be above the law. That's where we are in this lawless age. The Constitution's been undermined. It's been denigrated. It's been trashed. It's been stamped upon. And now it's just every man doing what seems right in his own eyes. I had a few of these clips from Herbert Armstrong's old radio program. I was going to play them later, but listen to what he said about people's personal convictions, even if they're wrong. This is clip 6.
Many people have such positive convictions about certain things that they are ready to fight when somebody disagrees. We even have wars that way. And in time of war, most of the people in any nation believe that their nation is in the right.
You see it in nations, you see it among political parties. I mean, people are drawing their lines in the sand. They are absolutely right on the one side, and the other side is absolutely wrong. Well, in the case of the new presidential administration, here comes Donald Trump, and he feels like the whole investigation and what motivated it from the very beginning is unjust and unconstitutional. And he firmly believes that James Comey broke the law. And same with McCabe and all the others. Now, what's amazing in this New York Post piece, and we touched on this just briefly yesterday, this January 6th meeting last year when Comey, then FBI Director Comey, briefed the president, President Trump. He's the president-elect at the time, and he's just a couple weeks away from becoming president. And you know some of the history there. Comey sits down with him one-on-one. He talks about the infamous Russian dossier. But basically just talks only about the salacious content of that dossier, specifically the prostitutes that President Trump was supposedly involved with years ago. And why didn't he tell the president, the incoming president, about a lot of other details? That's what the New York Post is asking. Comey explained in an interview with Jake Tapper. This is from back in April when he was on his book tour. But here's him explaining why he didn't tell President-elect Trump about all of these other allegations and about all of these other things that were going on behind the scenes. This is clip 13.
In January 2017, when you met with President Trump and you did that oral presentation of what's in that two-page memo summarizing the Steele dossier, we know from the book that you talked about these unverified allegations involving him and prostitutes. Did you brief him about any of the other things in the Steele dossier, claims that his associates, Michael Cohen or Paul Manafort, were potentially working with the Russians, or was it only about the prostitutes?
It was only about the salacious part of it.
Why? Why only about that?
Because that was the part that the leaders of the intelligence community agreed he needed to be told about, because we knew it and thought it was about to become public. And if it was true, we didn't know whether it was true, it would be important to let him know this as part of a defensive briefing.
So we only told him about the Russian prostitutes. That's what the intelligence community agreed upon. And it was part of this defensive briefing. We just wanted to prepare him. We were trying to protect him. And then, as we now know, it was James Clapper, the next day or 2 days later, who went to Jake Tapper, as it happens, the one that was in there interviewing Comey in that clip I just played. He tells CNN about the briefing. Andy McCabe, the number two man at the FBI, he was bragging at the same time, days before that CNN report came out. He was bragging to people in the DOJ and the FBI that, hey, the flood against Trump, it's about to hit. It's coming. It's gonna hit the news wires. And what else was going on right around this time? Well, the meeting, as you just heard there, was in January 6th, 2017, and it was January 5th, the day before, that Comey and Clapper and all of them were together with the Obama people, Barack Obama, Vice President Biden, as they were deciding then and there, okay, he needs to be briefed, and here's what you need to brief him on. Just the prostitutes. Now listen to this from the Post. It says, consider the things Comey withheld from Trump that January day. The list starts with the fact that he didn't tell the president-elect that Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee paid for the dossier, or that it was compiled by Christopher Steele, a former British spy. Comey didn't tell Trump the FBI had Steele on its payroll and fired him for misleading agents about media contacts. He didn't tell Trump there was a surveillance warrant on Carter Page, a fringe player in the campaign, or that the dossier was used in the FISA court application to get the warrant. Most incredible of all, Comey didn't mention that the investigation into Trump's campaign was still ongoing at that very moment. None of this was revealed to the incoming president. It says, imagine that. He could have said, Mr. President-elect, I have to tell you, the investigation into possible collusion with Russia continues even as we speak, but he didn't. He didn't say that. He didn't say any of that. That was no mere oversight, the Post writes. It was a deliberate choice approved by Obama. It was approved, you see, by the Antiochus administration. The Post says here, nor did Comey tell Trump about Stephen Halper, the American professor in Great Britain recently outed as the spy who approached three members of the Trump team trying to see if they knew anything about collusion or trying to entrap them. One or the other. It says, the things Comey didn't mention are astonishing when you remember that Trump would take the oath of office in just 2 weeks. The new commander-in-chief was deliberately being kept in the dark by the outgoing administration. And now, I mean, now today, the press up in arms over presidential pardons, over the executive power, the power of the executive branch. And look at what was happening in the Obama administration on the way out, as I said yesterday. I mean, just a few days after this meeting that Comey had with the president-elect, you had President Obama expanding the powers of the intelligence community. Certainly not because he wanted to hand over more authority and more power to President Trump. He despised President Trump. He thought he was a buffoon, a misogynist, a racist, all those things. He expanded the power of those agencies just a week or so before a new president was inaugurated, because he knew those agencies were corrupt. He knew it was all politicized. They had already been weaponized, those agencies. John Brennan, he headed up the CIA. He had an op-ed the other day where he talked about the criticism he's taken because of so many of his angry tweets aimed at President Trump. He says his criticisms were never political. I've never been and will never be a partisan, he said. And I'm sure they all would say that. But if that's the case, where were these intelligence heads? Where were these individuals knocking on the door of President-elect saying, look, we've got to fill you in on this. This is what's going on. This is what's happened. This is who's behind this dossier. This was used to get a wiretap. There was a spy or an informant or whatever you want to call him And we have to tell you the truth. We think that Carter Page, we think that Papadopoulos, they might be shady guys. They might be connected to Russia. Your campaign might have been compromised. If they're above the fray, Brennan and Clapper and McCabe and all of them, where were they trying to help the next administration? All that he sat down and talked to the president about, Jim Comey, all that he sat down and talked to him about was the salacious gossip, the unverified gossip. And so in comes President Trump, and he starts fighting back. Let me just finish this Post piece. So what was Comey up to with that very limited briefing? It's possible the sole purpose was to mention the prostitutes, then give CNN the story as a way to inject the dossier into the political bloodstream and hope Trump would step aside. Or perhaps the goal was to monitor how Trump reacted. Recall that the investigation was still secret. All of this was secret at the time. Page was still being surveilled, and other campaign players, including Flynn, were being picked up incidentally on other wiretaps. Maybe Trump was too. It says finally in his book, Comey writes that Martha Stewart was prosecuted for lying about a stock sale to reinforce a culture of truth-telling. Fair enough. But to truly reinforce a culture of truth-telling, those who enforce the laws must be held to at least the same standard as everyone else. That's the most important message Trump is sending with the pardons of people prosecuted by Comey and his cronies. Even the FBI is not above the law. And so this is what President Trump is now doing, using his executive power to not only roll back a lot of the executive actions of the previous administration going around Congress, but he's using the executive power to fight back. You really do have to wonder if any of them ever thought Donald Trump would still be around after a month or two. Forget about 500 days. He's still here. He's still fighting. He's fighting back, and more of the deep state, more and more of those evils are being exposed, and they hate it. And they hate what he says, and they hate what he tweets. He tweeted yesterday. I saw it when I got done with the radio show, and as soon as I saw it, I thought, this will send them into a frenzy, for sure. He said yesterday, as has been stated by numerous legal scholars, I have the absolute right to pardon myself. But why would I do that when I haven't done anything wrong? Yes, just so you know, I do have the power. But why would I do it? I haven't done anything wrong. He says, in the meantime, the never-ending witch hunt, led by 13 very angry and conflicted Democrats and others, continues into the midterms. And so that dominated the news cycle all through the day. And as soon as Sarah Huckabee Sanders got up during the White House press briefing and gave her opening remarks, the very first question came from Jonathan Carl. Here's clip two.
Sir, just a short time ago, the president said that I have an absolute right to pardon myself. Why does he think that? And does he also agree with Rudy Giuliani, his lawyer, that a pardon for himself would be unthinkable and would lead to immediate impeachment?
Thankfully, the president hasn't done anything wrong and wouldn't have any need for a pardon.
But does he absolutely rule out doing that? I mean, does he rule out ever issuing a pardon for himself?
Once again, thankfully, the president hasn't done anything wrong and therefore wouldn't need one.
And so there's the answer over and again. But they weren't satisfied, the press corps, the White House press corps, further on in the briefing. Here's clip three.
Does the president believe that he is above the law?
Certainly not. The president hasn't done anything wrong.
He's done anything wrong. I guess the question is, does the president believe the framers envisioned a system where the president couldn't pardon himself, where the president could be above the law?
Certainly the Constitution very clearly lays out the law. And once again, the president hasn't done anything wrong, and we feel very comfortable in that front.
But you just a moment ago said it's not that clear. So I guess simply put, does the president believe he is above the law?
Certainly no one is above the law. Okay.
Certainly no one is above the law. But there is something in the Constitution about the power of pardon that the president does have. And so that's the big debate now. And on whatever side you come down on, this is the arguing. The one side saying, you're saying you're above the law. And the other side saying you're above the law. Where's the solution in this? What's going to bring America back together? I mean, we're seeing a resurgence. We're seeing some good news. We're seeing some good signs abroad. But you look beneath the surface and you see, I mean, the sickness. It runs deep. Well, we can leave it to the legal scholars to argue over the pardon power. But as I guess I don't need to play this, it's a little bit long, but it was Mark Levin, I believe, on Fox last night, who said that the Constitution is the president's friend. I mean, he's just there saying, look, use the Constitution. Use the power afforded you in the Constitution. And he and his team of lawyers, they're doing that. There was a story at the New York Times today. The New York Times is now very concerned about presidential overreach. Very concerned. This is very disturbing, what we're seeing. This is the lead. President Trump ramping up his assertions of extraordinary powers, declared in a tweet on Monday that he had the absolute right to pardon himself for any crime. But then the rest of that tweet, of course, they leave that out. Why would I? I didn't do anything wrong. And Sarah Huckabee Sanders says it over and over again. He hasn't done anything wrong. Of course he's not above the law. No one is. But the New York Times, this is dangerous, they want you to know. Last month, it says, Mr. Trump crossed a traditional line by ordering an investigation into the Russia investigators. And then late last year, he boasted that he has an absolute right to do what I want to do with the Justice Department. Now, I mean, I think you could safely argue that he could tone it down somewhat, the rhetoric, but at the same time, you have to wonder when he sends a tweet out like he did yesterday morning, you have to wonder if he knows exactly what kind of reaction he's going to get. And then the press, they're off and running again, just obsessed. Obsessed with every little thing that he tweets. Well, he does want some answers. He does want this investigation looked into because the investigators are not above the law. And is he over the Justice Department? Is he over who? If he's not over the FBI or the Justice Department, who is? It says he has unfettered authority to fire the FBI director, which he did last year, to order a federal investigation opened or closed, and to pardon anyone, including felons or criminal suspects. His longtime personal lawyer, Mark E. Kasowitz, said in a confidential memo last June. Well, I mean, he does have that kind of authority, but does the New York Times remember anything that happened before January 20th, 2017? Seriously. It's not just 500 days of history here. It says, we overthrew control by a monarchy. And now they're bringing in the expert. This is the New York Times article. We overthrew control by a monarchy, and the Constitution signals in multiple places that the president is subject to the law. Listen, we rebelled against a monarchy that was oppressive. We don't want a king. Well, in fact, you look at Amos 7 and... well, Jeroboam actually is referred to as a king. That's a pretty good indication that this is a president that's going to wield some power. Well, it talks about others, the New York Times. It helpfully points out others that have used a lot of executive power. Others like Ronald Reagan, like George Bush, like Richard Nixon. All the Republicans. It's not even trying to disguise its partisanship. All those lawless Republicans, the way the New York Times sees it. But then there's this whopper. Listen to this. Mr. Trump's lawyers, by contrast, are claiming that he is the chief law enforcement officer, a description usually applied to the attorney general. So the Times wants it to be the Attorney General, not the president, wielding absolute power to command the actions of every federal prosecutor or FBI agent in a way no congressional statute can limit. And he's doing so in the context of an investigation aimed at uncovering the scope of a foreign power's covert meddling with American democracy and whether he personally obstructed that inquiry. The implications, listen to this, the implications of Mr. Trump's claim also go beyond the context of his lawyers defending him in a criminal case. If obstruction statutes cannot stop Mr. Trump from shutting down an investigation, even if he did so with a corrupt motive, then Justice Department procedures and regulations also cannot stop him from ordering an investigation into his political opponents for corrupt reasons. If that is not the pot calling the kettle black, I don't know what is. Here you had a previous administration ordering an investigation into his political opponents. And the New York Times, willfully blind. The hypocrisy here. The president hasn't even called off any investigation. And I'm not even sure there's even any investigation into the investigators up and running yet. He did fire Comey at the suggestion, at the recommendation of Rosenstein. And that's it. All the rest, it's a tweet here. I can pardon. I can do this. If I need to, I can do that. But where is he firing whoever among the investigators? Where is he stopping the investigation? Here's the New York Times saying that, look, while Britain's kings traditionally wielded a prerogative power to suspend or dispense with laws, the framers of the Constitution required the American president to faithfully execute those laws. It's a shame we didn't get more of that over the past 10 years when the Constitution was being trashed, when Barack Obama was talking about it as being, you know, a negative charter. It's negative. And what we need are positive ideas, positive policies, positive executive actions. And he had a lot of them, positives as far as he was concerned. When we come back, speaking of positives, real positives, we'll conclude today's program talking about the exhibit, and we'll play for you that two-minute clip from KWTV9 in Oklahoma City, the Sunday interview with Brad McDonald and Shane Granger. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. The Trumpet Daily.
We've got some friends here from Armstrong Auditorium today, Brad McDonald and Shane Granger. Welcome, guys. Thanks for being here.
It's good to be here.
Good morning.
Yeah, and we're usually talking about performing arts at the Armstrong Auditorium, but you guys have a really cool exhibit that's starting next weekend, right?
Right. We have 40 artifacts coming from Israel. All of these artifacts come from the 8th century, so 700 to 800 years before Christ. Of these artifacts, they pertain to history between Assyria's invasion of Judah. We have iron arrowheads that were used in the famous siege of Lachish. We have old ancient sling stones.
Yeah, we got some pictures here. This is some of it, right?
These are the stars of the show. These two bullae, one of them says, one of them identifies King Hezekiah of Judah, and one identifies Isaiah the prophet. They've never been on display, so this will be the first time they're exhibited in the world.
Wow, right here in Edmond, Oklahoma,
that's
huh?
That's right.
Yeah, that's very cool. And so this exhibit has, you said there's a lot of artifacts then, right?
There's 40 artifacts, and then we've surrounded the artifacts with four or five videos, a timeline, an interactive wow. iPad app. We've built a cross-section of Hezekiah's tunnel from Jerusalem. And so we're using all of these artifacts, storyboards, massive maps to just tell the story of the artifacts. So we think it's pretty special. We think, we hope people will like it.
Yeah, what can people learn from it?
Oh, they can learn all about the history, this ancient history in Judah. They can learn about Assyria's invasion. They can learn about this awesome axis between King Hezekiah and the prophet Isaiah, and how through that axis, you know, God saved a city and a nation. All kinds of great history.
Brad, the curator, and it all starts next weekend, right?
That's right. Sunday, June the 10th at 11 a.m. is the grand opening, and tickets are still available, so you can come to the door and buy a ticket next Sunday. And then it runs through August the 19th, and after next Sunday, it'll be free and open to the public every day except Saturday. And we would just invite people to come out and enjoy this amazing exhibit, these amazing artifacts. 2018 is a big year for Armstrong. We're celebrating our 50-year anniversary with Jerusalem and archaeology, going all the way back to 1968 when Herbert Armstrong and Benjamin Mazar founded all of this. So it's very exciting. Oklahoma's hosting the world premiere, and we couldn't be happier.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Guys, thank you.
Good stuff. Some good stuff there. That's Shane Granger, the last one speaking there with the reporter, and then Brad McDonald before him, both of them describing the new exhibit that starts this Sunday, June 10th. And speaking of the exhibit, more positive publicity, this time coming from Breitbart Jerusalem. Brent in Jerusalem, our correspondent in Jerusalem, said that Joel Pollack, he's the author of this piece at Breitbart. He's also the senior editor at large at Breitbart News. But according to Brent, there was a lower-level reporter assigned to this story initially. But for whatever reason, Mr. Pollack decided to take it on himself. He called Dr. Mazar last night. He had a short, it's probably 500 words or so. He had a short article put together and posted on Breitbart Jerusalem today. You can probably get to it even now if you want to go and hunt for that in a Google search. But he says here, ancient biblical era, seals of King Hezekiah, Isaiah, to be unveiled in Oklahoma. That's another reference to Oklahoma in a big headline from Breitbart Jerusalem. Same thing with the Jerusalem Post early last week, if you remember. It says, clay artifacts bearing the seal of King Hezekiah and possibly the seal of the prophet Isaiah are to be unveiled in Edmond, Oklahoma on Sunday. And he explains here how there's no doubt, he's quoting Dr. Mazar for part of it, saying that there's no doubt about the Hezekiah bulla. There's maybe a sliver of doubt for Isaiah. And that's the way I think most of the scholars and the reporters are probably going to treat the subject. We'll most likely be a little more emphatic than what they are. But in any event, he talks about the dramatic story of how Hezekiah resisted the Assyrian siege of Jerusalem with help from Isaiah. It's told in 2 Kings 18 and 19 and in 2 Chronicles 32. And how that story is going to be, it's going to be there recounted in this special exhibition. Seals of Isaiah and King Hezekiah discovered. And then there's a reference to Edmund's Armstrong Auditorium and the length of the exhibit. It says further on in the piece, an opening ceremony will be held at the Armstrong Auditorium at 11 a.m. Central Daylight Time on June 10th, to be joined via simulcast by a companion ceremony at Jerusalem's King David Hotel. And then he talks about the relationship between Mr. Armstrong and the Mazar family. The discoveries were made possible by the partnership between Herbert W. Armstrong College, and with its deep roots in the Church of God, and the late Benjamin Mazar, Elot's grandfather, whose work she has continued. Dr. Mazar told Breitbart News that a new technique of wet sifting made the discovery of the bulla possible. And then he goes on to describe how that, ironically, this technique was developed, it was developed in the last 18 years. It's a modern technique. It was developed after the Muslim religious authorities were destroying the Temple Mount basically removing large truckloads of earth from underneath the Temple Mount. And the Jewish archaeologists got in there and developed this wet sifting technique to try to see if there were anything in the dumps. And wet sifting is what came out from that. So we'll probably use that as a lead-in to the study that I want to get into soon, hopefully tomorrow. But we're out of time for today, but lots to be thinking about and to be very excited about in the days ahead, particularly as we come closer to the start of the exhibit. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.